Welcome to Veterans Connected, where maintenance and reliability expert and military veteran Eric Bevavino connects with fellow veterans in the industry during each episode, exchanging their experiences and discussing the transition from the military to industry and the resources that led them to where they are today. The Veterans Connected podcast is proudly produced by the industry's leading network and learning community, Mobius Connect. Eric, over to you.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Eric Bevavino, host of the Mobius Connect podcast focused on connecting military veterans to the maintenance and reliability community. Our aim here is to bridge the understanding gap between the military and civilian worlds, thereby improving the veteran transition experience and ultimately providing hope and a helping hand to any of our brothers and sisters out there struggling to find their way. We'll do this by interviewing veterans who have successfully made it through. For this session, we've chosen to interview one such Navy veteran, a dive school buddy of mine and long-term friend, Mike Sherwin. Mike remained on active duty much longer than I did and has since successfully transitioned into the world of higher education. Mike's fascinating and patriotic story is a must-listen for anyone joining us on this mission. Hey, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, where are you coming to us from today?
San Antonio, Texas.
San Antonio.
Yeah.
Down deep south.
Yeah.
Is it hot there today?
Oh, I know. It's a little cool this morning. My son's got, he always wears t-shirt and shorts. He won't wear pants. We're in San Antonio. So he's like, it's a little chilly. We should wear a jacket. I'm like, nah, it's fine. It'll be fine to warm up. Because it always warms up to like 85 by the middle of the day.
Yeah, caution him if he ever chooses to take his career up to Minnesota or Wisconsin, where you're from.
Oh, originally, yeah. Right? Well, I'm from upstate New York, which is even worse. Syracuse.
Upstate New York. Okay.
Yeah, that's yeah. Okay. We get the highest rate of snowfall in the nation. So.
Right on, right on. Well, thanks for being with us. And actually, before we get started, I want to give our listeners some backstory, which might be helpful. You and I met in the summer of 1990 in mm-hmm. Panama City, Florida, where we were both sent for U.S. Navy Basic Diving Officer, Salvage Officer, and Fundamentals of Munitions mm-hmm. schools, which lasted, I don't know, about a year.
Eight months.
Yeah. And since we were both ROTC grads, you came from Marquette, is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Marquette, and me at Penn State. We formed a quick and lifelong friendship still today, obviously, and keeping up through the years. We've been conversing more and more about our own series of transitions, which lead us to today and what Mike's up to, which is, what are you doing today, Mike?
I'm an adjunct faculty at Northwest Vista College. It's one of the Alamo colleges. In San Antonio area, we have about total, the Alamo College is about 90,000 students. Our school has 20,000. So we're one of the larger ones. So
great. And what are you teaching? Yeah.
Mathematics. I teach basically called liberal arts math, statistics, college algebra, and stuff like that.
Were you a math major in college?
No, I was not. I tell my students all the time. I majored in history, but I went to Naval Postgraduate School after my tours on the ships. And then I got enough math in that I could teach math. So
what degree did you get at Navy?
Information systems and operations, but I started in operations research and they were moving people over to information systems because it was a new curriculum. So I pulled people out of different curriculums, but I had taken enough math that I was just a little short. I was at 16 credit hours for graduate level math. And so I didn't realize that I was highly qualified to teach math.
So when how'd you discover that?
Yeah, well, I went in. I was doing wanted to go troops to teachers, and then there's alternative teaching out there. Now the company's called Teachworthy out of San Antonio, and they review your records, your transcripts from college and your graduate school. And the guy looked at it and said, "I want to teach history." He goes, "Okay, let me look what you got." He comes back and he writes in the top of my application, math, and he goes, "I go, what about history?" And he goes, "Math." And I'm like, "Going, why math?" Math. You want a job? Teach math. And so sure enough, there was 150 people in the program. And when we did training sessions, they put us with the math and science. And out of 150 people, I was the only one for high school math. And so
wow.
I'm like, what? I'm the only math guy? And the guy's like, yeah, out of 150 people applying to be teachers.
Interesting. Interesting. So you taught some high school then?
Yeah, I taught high school for 2 years. I ran into a couple other people that I have I served with down in New Orleans and on ships and stuff. And funny that all of them are teaching math, because we get the math in the Navy. You know, navigation's all math. So we get enough math that they put us in there, especially engineering too. So we're naturally the math.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're from the similar vintage, right? You know, late 50s, and we were in at the time where there weren't a lot of automated tools. You had to do a lot of the math in your head, actually, as far as time distance equations and whatnot. That probably helps out too.
You remember the movie? It's too close for Mobord. Got to eyeball it.
Yeah, right. T-bones. I love that. Great nautical bridge watch reference for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that brings back lots of memories.
Oh, yeah.
But, so, okay. So you got into teaching, and let's, before we like really go through all that, let's dial it back a few years and talk about, you know, what led you to seeking a commission in the Navy. Like, where did it all start? It sounds like you grew up in upstate New York and then moved over to Marquette, and then, then through dive school, and then through your various assignments and what you did through the Navy, because it's an interesting route. There's no doubt about it. And maybe similar, I suspect, to one of our other guests, Eric Hummel from the Air Force, who was on active duty Air Force and then went to like a TAR position training in administration or reserves. But, we both actually several of us on this podcast kind of going towards the Navy diving community, which is fine. You know, I got a lot of friends in the Navy diving community, but there are multiple officers that we've talked to that all hit this sort of point in 1994, where you had to make a decision of what you were going to do. But I will leave that back to your story, and I'll hand it off to you. Where did it start? You know, why were you thinking about a commission and all that?
Well, the same probably idea of why you did it, because it seemed like a good idea at the time. Because, you know, you're like, come on. I don't know. Maybe I'll do this. I don't know. And it was kind of
free college. College job after you graduated.
And I got commissioned. Yeah, when I got commissioned, it was funny. My dad just looked at me. My mom had told me later on, because it caught your dad completely off guard, because he never saw it coming. And I'm like, wow, because he didn't figure that I would do it. But we have a ton of kids that come in ROTC. We had class like 80 kids or whatever. And you wind up graduating like 20. So you lose like 60 of them. You lose what, 75% of kids drop out.
And this is high. Sorry, Mike.
That's college.
Was that your high? That was your college. Oh my
God. We had 80 in our class, and we commissioned 20 at the end.
Oh, 80 in the freshman year. That's a lot smaller than the Penn State crew. For sure.
We had 80 to start with. We graduated 20 only. That's how attrition was pretty bad.
Was your dad in the military, or
he did when he went to he went to University of Dayton for his undergrad? But my dad's tapping one ear, so he's not missing his middle ear, one ear. So he had to do. They did ROTC the first 2 years. It was Vietnam time, right before Vietnam. And so they had to test him. They found out. He looked at him, goes, "Yeah, you're deaf in one ear. You're out. Have a nice day." So he couldn't make it. I kicked him out.
You're either deaf when you go in or deaf when you come out, right?
Yeah, no, that's essentially what's the big deal? You lost hearing anyway.
Yeah.
So it was all that.
Okay, so he was medically non-qualified to go to Vietnam. And so that wasn't a major influence. You were just like, hey, it's a good idea. I get my college paid for. I mean, Marquette is a good school, and you get a job when you graduate. So
Yeah, I got the three-year scholarship after the freshman year I picked up.
Okay.
As my dad said sarcastically, you're going to cost me more in financial aid. I'm going to come over out of pocket now. My brother and sister were in school. So my sister was mad at me. He goes, you're costing me money. I'm like, hey, I got a scholarship. Okay, whatever.
Cost you a little here, a little there.
It's came on the wash.
Right on. So you graduate with a history degree. Was that, what was your Marquette ROTC experience like? Was that good?
It was a lot of fun. Because, we were just, in Milwaukee was a lot of good time. We had good clubs. Played flag football. We've been against Madison, Northwestern, the Army, and a bunch of other stuff. We had a good time. There was a lot of stuff we could do. It was a really good experience. Came against kind of like a good group. And most of the people I know from Marquette are guys I knew from ROTC. They're the ones I keep in touch with.
But yeah.
Because you kind of bond.
For sure. Yeah. It's a coming of age experience, yeah. Right? You know, going from high school to college and then from college into the service. So did you decide on Navy diving like early? I mean, I have my own story about how I got to Navy diving, but how did that come up for you?
They're looking at different options. And then, do I want to just drive ships? Why don't I do something different? So I saw the 1140 community. I'm like, hey, when I tried doing that, because I couldn't be a SEAL because I always wear glasses. So that wasn't going to happen. And another friend of mine, Dave, he went to Buds and was a SEAL. He was a class 88. And I had talked to him. He goes, I do fleet diver or I'll do SEALs. If I can't get into SEALs, I'll do fleet diver. And that's where I learned about it. Because he had gone to scuba school over the summer and he told me.
Okay. Gotcha. So he got you interested. You wanted to do something different. I too wanted to do something different and probably have related to this in other podcasts, but it was just sort of an out of the blue thing for me. A personnelman, felt sorry for me and said, well, if you consider this, and showed me a picture of a diver on the side, with this helmet and everything. I'm like, well, I didn't even know I could do that. And he's like, we got a couple spots, slated for us. Never been scuba diving or anything. you hadn't either?
I know I'd swam a lot, but I never dove. Yeah, but actually, we found out later on, it's best that you didn't do PADI now or you're in that before you went.
Yeah.
And if you announce it. So it's good because they want to teach you from scratch, not with no bad habits and stuff.
Well, or some sort of vision of, here's how it's going to go. I already got this licked and, it's just not. Yeah, I mean, you can't. I don't believe you can put in a civilian context, put people through what we went through in dive school because we signed the contract that like we're in it, whatever. Yeah. Go ahead and train us the way you want to. And then, do flutter kicks on the side of the pool with the mask full of water and, choke it through your, the back of your throat while you're trying to count. But So that was college. And then we met in Panama City and, we were all 22 and fit and, ready to go and doing all that. And that was a good time. I mean, it was basically kind of an extension of college and I pretty much.
That was.
I mean, it was hard, right? It was physically hard. Yeah. I would say, from a schoolwork standpoint, anybody with, any sort of intense degree, I mean, can figure it out as long as you have a math and a physics background. So that worked out. And and then where did you go after dive school?
Oh, dive school. We had to go to SWAS, remember? Because I had to go. I think you.
Oh, you did. You did SWAS after dive school.
Yeah, SWAS. Then I went to SWAS, and then I did DCA school, and then I went to recovery. That's my first ship.
So DCA for our listeners is
damage control assistant school. So
okay, so that's an engineering, position, firefighting, main space, that type of thing. Okay, and then you, and what was your first ship?
USS Recovery, ARS 43, built in 1946 in Balsett Rock Company, in a quarry in, it was somewhere in San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where they were all built, the 50 classes. And I think the preserver, yours was too, when you were in preserver. They flooded a rock quarry, and they built them in there.
In California?
I think it was California, the Balsett Rock Company.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, some reason I thought preserver was built somewhere else. But anyway, you're the history guy, so I'm sure you're
sure
correct.
How much are you?
Sorry?
Yours was a little older, so I'm not sure.
So I, in my 4 years, I decommissioned an ARS, the Preserver ARS-8.
Yeah.
And then MSO 440, which, both these ships were built in the 50s, right? Yeah. 40s and 50s. But anyway, so you land on the ship, your first ship as a, you're still an ensign or were you a JG at that time?
I was still an ensign when I got on board. It was
okay.
Good.
Yeah. What jobs did you have there?
I was DCA and then I was ops. And then at the end, they had some reliefs coming on and I was getting ready to roll off. So I became I called the little jobs officer, so I get a little hat that says Slow Joe, SLJO.
That is a common term, yes, yeah, for those who haven't heard it before, yeah, SLJO, yeah.
Yeah, and Babette Boulevard, she was an XO. So she kept me all these, why am I getting all this stuff? You're getting, so I'm the shitty little jobs officer. So she was giving me all this stuff, and I still helped out with the ops and stuff like that. And I was always the GQOD. I was always CN anchor and everything until I rolled off. And then I left in, was it May, after we went through all this stuff. And we had a good job in St. John's right before we left. It was like March. I saw the picture that Mass Driver Zagurski, Jeff Zagurski, sent out. They saw the picture
on the front. On Facebook, yeah. There's a rotation of dive locker pictures.
Going around.
So, yeah, gotcha. Yep.
Yeah, so we put that out there. We were in St. John's at the time. So when I finally got my warfare qualification, whatever, they decided to give it to me. That was when Babette jammed it into my chest. And then Chief Woody and Cuz, they threw me overboard.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, in little St. John's. They popped in and they go, hey, I got an award ceremony. And then Cousin Woody goes, sir, just don't fight it. Took me out, threw me overboard. And there was a good current and I'm getting swept out away from the ship. And I still remember Chief Woody is talking to Master Service Gersh going, hey, look at the current kicking his ass. And also I'm like, I'm trying to swim against it and I'm going further and further away from the ship. And they couldn't get the boat started. And I'm like, ship's getting smaller.
See you guys. I got my swell pin. I'm out of here.
And I'm sitting out there in the middle of the bay between St. John's and St. Thomas. And I still remember that. And then finally got the boat underway and they got me back on board. I'm like, you guys, killing me.
Well, that's a story. That's definitely a story. So you got your swell pin tacked on by your XO. They threw you overboard in the current, swept you away.
She didn't bother putting the backing on. She put it on and she goes, bam, with a big smile across her face. I was like, ah.
Welcome to the club. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It was a lot of fun. There was like those things you did. Nowadays, that ain't happening. People get in trouble.
Yeah, there's no bleeding and pin ceremonies from one.
But it was good. It was way back in the early 90s. We did all kinds of crazy stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, that's too bad. That's a character building experience for sure.
Hell yeah, it was a lot of
fun.
And
a great story. A great story.
Oh, yeah.
So where did you go next then?
After that, I went to Mudsu 2. But on the way to Mudsu 2, the diving officer on the Puget Sound had an incident. So he had to leave. He was a warrant officer. He was a prior Vietnam SEAL. And so he had a little PTSD going on. So he came on board drunk, beat up the quarterdeck watch. And then the Master Arms Force came, took them all out. And then
allegedly,
the chiefs to hold them down. And I heard the story, but I'm going, what? And so he had to leave the ship. And so they needed a diving officer. So I got drafted. And I didn't know they had already had my name because Lieutenant Commander Scott Barkus was the chief of staff. And he already threw me under the gun. Oh, yeah, Sherwin's going. So I already had the notification of the ship because I was going to go on the Puget Sound. And so I get there and I grabbed my stuff, packed up, went to the ship, threw my stuff in there, had my temporary orders, and I left. Went on deployment with the Puget Sound, which was a great tour.
Nice, nice. And, well, yeah, you were supposed to go to shore duty then.
Yeah, so yeah, I went to Mudsu too.
Considered shore duty? Or?
Yeah, for officers, yes and no, but I was deploying anyway. So I got on board and I took off with them. It was a great experience. My this came in handy because my captain on there, his name's Captain H.K. Klein, and he was the captain on there. He became CTF 63 later on when I was XO in Grasp, which was kind of cool because I already knew the Commodore ahead of time. So I spent like 4 or 5 months on there working with him and found out, a lot of the guys in the tenders don't have a lot of experience at sea. So the ops boss came in. It was funny. She was a supply officer beforehand. So she didn't know how to run an operate 5 feeders or anything. So we get underway for the first day, and I'm walking around because, I'm coming from a small ship, and I'm going to this big, huge ship that was, massive. So I'm walking around. I talk to the ops boss, and he's got the operate 5 feeder. And I look at him and goes, hey, what's he got going on? He goes, you got the wrong one, man. He's got the 6th Fleet 1, and we need the 2nd Fleet 1. And I go, hey, let's go find it. Because I don't know. This is all I have. So I go up to see the ops. He goes, do you have the feeder? She goes, well, that's it. He goes, no, it's not. So where's the old files? So I pulled the old files. I was digging through. I go, ha, found it. So he's like, what is that? This is one you're supposed to use. She didn't know which one to use. So I'm in there typing away, getting all the information, and the XO comes in, and it was Dana Eberlin. He walked in, he goes, ops, where's the feeder message? And why is the new diving officer on your computer? Well, he goes, write the Operate 5 feeder. I said, I'll have it to you in a minute. I'm typing it all up.
Well, I mean, that's the truth, right?
Yeah.
When you're on the small boys, it's in the SLJO, one of those – one of those tasks can be a communication officer, or it can be what was the crypto gear? What
CMS
do we call it?
Custodian.
EMS, yeah, CMS custodian, yeah. So you get broad experience in a lot of different areas. There are just not as many people there, right?
Yeah,
certainly not as many officers. Yeah, you get it quick. Yeah,
and remember you had like 15 collateral duties, because they have the same collateral duties as the big ship does. So you get all of them go, hey, when I become the historian? Yesterday. I just changed it.
start taking pictures. Yeah.
It was all that. You're like, how am I getting this job? That was funny. So it's the way it is. So it was a good experience to do that. I had a dive locker. I had six chiefs out of 18 guys. Then I got six chiefs and two senior chiefs, including the master diver. So I'm like, because guys, I don't make decisions here. I sign chits, okay? If there's eight of you E7 and above's here, what job do I have?
Learn from us. That's your job. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I sit there and I walk around and they'd be like hanging out. When you're in transit, you have nothing to do. So I was in the gym all the time or helping the ops boss and everything. And that's really got the captain would pull me aside. He goes, hey, thanks for helping my ops boss out. And, you know, I got good with him. Then when I became XO on Grasp, when we deployed, he was the Commodore. So it was really cool when I'm sitting there in Naples, Italy, and he walks on board. He goes, Mike, good to see you, because I hadn't seen him in a long time.
Nice. Yeah. Well, for the military folks who listen to this or prior military veterans, XO means XO across the board, right? Executive officer, second in charge. For the folks from the civilian world listening to this, I mean, we're going to throw a lot of acronyms out there and we can help with any of them. But, and if you watched any military movies, you know, the executive officer is sort of the second in command, where the CO or the captain's the first in command. So you were XO on Grasp. That was one of the newer ships,
It was the 50 class that I do. And I had three COs, cause I've been there so long. Cause what happened was in 94, it's about the decision to get out. Remember they started offering early outs, $50,000 bonus. So they overshot the number of people that got out. And so they happened to be short department heads at sea.
Mm-hmm. So this is what I referenced before, the 94 time frame.
Yes.
Where it was like, okay, we don't need any more salvage officers. We need more EOD officers. So go EOD or get out or do something else.
Yeah.
So that's what you're referencing. And this is more color. It also goes to the two prior interviews for the two ladies from the Naval Academy. Actually one went EOD, the other one went Intel. I think Laura went Intel and Kathy went EOD at the time. So it's another, what nuances we were talking about? So there was an overshooting of the goal on the amount of attrition.
Yeah. They let too many people left the surface warfare community. And so on that side, there was not enough XOs at sea. And so the detailers were under the gun for somebody to relieve the ships on the salvage ships. So I got says, hey, you get drafted to go. So I got drafted and we'll send you your ID afterwards. So what happened was I got on there and there weren't any reliefs coming in. So it got to a point where I wasn't going to get relieved and I wasn't. So I went from an 18-month tour to a 31-month tour, trying to find somebody to come in to take over for me. So I went through three COs. I was on my third CO, which was the third CO was Eric Anderson, which I was JOs with him on recovery. And
okay.
That was interesting. And I had Ron Harrell the whole time. Second, he had 20 months on there. I was the XO the whole time, which he was the most amazing CO I ever had. I'm still really good friends with him right now. He's very successful. And he convinced me that I need to switch to the TAR community. training reserves because you're too long in the tooth now. You're going up for lieutenant commander, and you're going to make it because you're on the highest op tempo ship in the Atlantic Fleet for 31 months as the XO. So you're going to make it. So sure enough, go in there. I switch over. I got my package, and he told Eric, my third CO, to switch over too. So Eric and I put our packages in. Sure enough, we both got selected. So we switched over to the Training Administration Reserves, which now I had a career path. Like people switching, like Laura did, go to Intel.
Yeah.
You got to go somewhere. So, because I'd spent too long at sea on GRASP. So going to EOD school would go in backwards.
I see.
I can't go backwards. I have to go forward. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. And this is where you go from being on a ship full time to being in DC full time? Is that where they sent you?
I was going to MPS, Naval Postgraduate School, for Ops
Research. Oh, okay.
They gave me that slot. Because I've been on there
Monterey,
California.
Yeah.
And so I started in Ops Research and I switched over to Information Systems, but I was there about 2 years. And basically, I got an Information Systems, so I kind of was working more technology within the Reserve Force. So I did that for 2 years. Great time in Monterey.
Nice place.
Good triathlons, running 10 miles in the morning before class, playing golf. It was great. It was amazing.
You earned it after being.
I know. It was like 31 months at sea. We were never home.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And the deployments, even that we were bouncing around so much too. I got to do the Black Sea deployment. We went through the Dardanelles. And
that's cool.
And we were always, Ron and I were pretty good stuff because they always tell you when you're in XO school that one of you should be on the bridge at any one time during crisis. Like the two destroyers are in each other. This one, the CO's on one of them, they collided, but the other one, the CO and XO weren't on the bridge. One of my classmates in XO school ran aground.
Mm-hmm.
So, because he wasn't on the bridge and the cat was on the bridge. They had some JO on there and he hit a beach on an MCM.
Oh.
How do you run aground on an MCM? It's only like a 10-foot draft.
Well, fiberglass hull too doesn't work. Not that any hull does well, but fiberglass, particularly not good.
Yeah. And I was the first, and I was at XO school, it's a good one, but I was the first Gen X in the class because I was so junior when I went. All you guys are baby boomers. And I go in the back, like I go, I'm not. And Commander Tejekma, he was a Marquette grad in like 75. So we talked. He goes, oh my God, you are a Gen X. I'm like, yes, I am. He's the first one. So I was the first Gen X in XO school. Everybody started looking at me. I believe Holly Graf was in my XO class too.
Mm.
I had all these other guys in there. They're pretty funny. I ran my future chief of staff at Res 4 was also there. So it was really cool that I get to meet all these people.
Yeah, right on.
And I was the most junior XO in the Atlantic Fleet because I was really young going in there. And I'd been there forever.
Well, that's the other advantage of being on small ships, right? Yeah. With a specialty sort of designator, you know, and knowledge, right? So you knew the mission probably better than anybody, right? So cool. All right. So what was it? Tell me more about that Dardanelle story. Was there more to that?
We were going through the Aegean going in there. So, Moran's like, he goes, hey, man. And he always did this to me all the time because he was awesome. He goes, hey, one of us is going to be on the bridge tonight going to the Aegean for the Dardanelles, and I'm going to give you a sleep. So, what do you think? So I'm going to be on the bridge anyway because I got to make sure we make the Dardanelles at 5 in the morning. So he goes, yeah. Great idea, XO. You got it. He would do that to me all the time. It was hilarious.
And what was the ship traffic like there? It was probably pretty.
Going to the Aegean, there's a lot of traffic going back and forth. There's ferry boats coming between the islands, and they go right there 24/7. So you have the junior officers on the bridge, and they don't have a lot of experience. And so you should be up there. So I sat in Max's chair and I watched, are we going to make it there on time? So I was up there the whole night. So I didn't sleep for like the whole transit. I was up for like 36 hours just because you have to. And so, we got through the Dardanelles. We got there right on time. That's just the sun's cracking up. The sun's going up because warships have to go through the Dardanelles and Bosporus during daylight. So I'm sweating it. So we're going through. We got all engines going flank, and we're like at 13 knots because we're going into the current. I'm like, dang it, we're not going to make it. So I'm sweating it the whole time. We get the Dardanelles, you can't see anything because it was fogged in. But we're the pilot knew where to go, so we're just hauling butt, getting up there. Get the Sea of Marmara. The current cuts off a little bit. We're making better headway. And we pull into the Bosporus, getting ready for the pilot pickup. And the pilot comes back. I talk to him. He goes, you have to come through daylight. I went, yes, the sun is up. We're coming into pilot. Vicka, we'll be there in a minute. So the pilot comes down. He's all pissed off. And I'm like, we're
going
to make
it. Oh, so the sun was going down.
Yeah, sun was going down.
It was later in the day. It wasn't early morning.
Because you transit all the way through. You have to cut all the way through, and you have to do it the whole time of the day. So we're getting through the Dardanelles, the Bosporus. We're about three quarters of the way through, and the sun sets. And I'm like,
75% there. I'll count.
And we're almost through. And so Chef, he gets up. He's all pissed off. And I'm like, cross my fingers. No international incident. I don't want the Turkish government yelling at our embassy, all that stuff. And we go through, and then all the traffic's coming in. It's at night. So we had everyone up because everyone's from all the Russian ships and everything. And of course, Jack Molesworth sent us all kinds of stuff. You know, all these Russian, of course, there's Russian ships coming in. It's Russia. I'm like, tell me something I don't know. Anyway, so you're going through and you're heading all the way up. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And we go up, and I told the captain, I said, don't worry about making a left. We'll just keep going up because we don't go to Varna, Bulgaria. And then it didn't take that long. So we had to loop all the way out and then loop, get a hole and cut through. And it was pretty tense because everyone was trying to jam into the Bosporus at the same time. So everyone gets in line, and so they're trying to line up. So it was heavy traffic. It was worse than the Gibraltar. But
interesting. Yeah, I never did a med cruise, but the most relevant experience that I had was getting in and out of the Panama Canal.
Yeah,
and being the OOD coming in there and just having the whole world of shipping wake up. All the anchored boats and everything like that. So yeah. pretty cool experience.
How many times did you go through the Panama Canal?
I've been to Panama probably five times in my career. I think we towed a submarine through it. So we just went back and forth through it.
Yeah, that was the op I used to work with. I had you guys going down for the Panama Canal Commission when I was at Mutsu too.
Yeah, so
people think it's down there because they needed.
Yeah, we handed off the Daglo ship actually.
We
didn't get a chance to connect while we were there, but so the Panama Canal, you go from north to south. You wouldn't think. You think it's east to west, but it's actually north to south. And we started in on that. And then the last time I went to Panama, it was probably, well, I retired 10 years ago. So we're talking probably maybe 12 or 13 years ago.
Yeah.
It was dramatically different than 30 years ago. When 30 years ago is still when we had all the ownership and the special forces compound on the north side was all clean and squared away and everything like this. This last time we were down there, we were actually doing an exercise. So it was an EOD support mission. So the divers would dive the boats, make sure they're clear of any mines or anything like that. Mines, you know, limpet mines attached to the bottom of the ship or on the pier or anything like that. But the special forces compound was totally run down, full of who knows, military criminals, whatever's over there.
I went through seven times total. I did like three or four times and then grasped it much. The last one I did. This is a funny story. Got this one. So we're pulling in, and I got Bosun Hodgson back. We were JOs on recovery. I got him back on the ship because I called Bosun. Hey, Bosun, are you available? He goes, I'll talk to the wife first. I said, Eric, give me the captain. He goes, what? Because we were all JOs together. And then I said, hey, I'm going to get you back on. And I got him on board when Ron was on there. I said, Ron, I'm getting Bosun Hodgson. He goes, yeah. So I got him on board, and Bosun had been on like four junk boats. So he was perfect because I'm trying to hook up Eric. And so Ron was like, man, where was Bosun there my entire tour? I wish I had him on here the whole time. And I said, I got him on there, and I got an EMC Schmidt, who was an EM1 on recovery. I got him as my electrical officer on Grassville. I was stacking the deck. And I got another Chief Rubo shows up. He goes, hey, XO, it's Chief Rubo. Can I come to your ship?
Everybody wants to be on, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because he was on recovery for us when we did the St. John's op. So I knew him. And I knew him at Mutsu too. So all these guys are calling me. They want to come to the ship. So I rerouted. I changed the NEC codes to the demo diver, demolition diver. So I rigged it so the detailer was all mad because I rigged it so Rubo got a vacation in Panama City for 6 weeks to blow stuff up. So he was loving it. Dude, I was blowing stuff up. We need a master diver later. So,
well, needless to say, we're working the system and you had the experience. And
yeah.
So after you're done with the ships and you went to graduate school and, you know, what did you do then? Like, this is the second half of your career.
Oh, right? My second half is because I wound up on Flagstaffs. And first one was when I was going through, and Ron, my boss, my old CEO, he was best friends with my detailer. They were JOs together. So he already detailed me down to New Orleans before I even knew it. So, because he called my, because he always helped me out. So he calls my detail and Ron sends me an email. He's, hey, man, you're all hooked up. You're next tour. You're going to New Orleans. I'm going, I didn't even talk to my detail yet. Yeah, but you're going to New Orleans. And so sure enough, I call my detail. He goes, yeah, I got down here. I guess you're going to New Orleans. I guess I'm going.
What was that command down in?
That was the Naval Reserve. Originally, it's the Naval Reserve Surface Forces Command. So okay. The surface and air forces were separate, then they had Res 4. So when I was there, they transitioned. They made it the Naval Reserve Forces Command, and they merged, took all the air reserve centers and the reserve centers and merged them into Forces Command. And they split off air into just the wings and the squadrons. So they changed it up. They changed the admin side to the operational side. They changed it up.
Did New Orleans ultimately move to Millington? Is that what happened part of it?
They moved to Norfolk eventually.
I gotcha.
Aligned with the fleet. So when I was down there, we created the Forces Command. And de facto, my boss was leaving and the new guy wasn't coming in. So I became the N7, the head director for the Naval Reserve Force, went during the transition. And I didn't know it because my boss got kind of let go and they didn't release on waivers. And they didn't tell me. And I'm sitting in my office and the chief staff calls, you might get your butt up here. I'm like, why? My boss must be, get up here, grab a pen, paper, get up here. So I walk up. I'm a lieutenant commander. All these guys are O6s. And I'm like, so what's going on? He goes, sit here, make sure you show the meetings from now on. I'm like, what happened? I don't know. He told me.
Just do your best, right?
Battlefield. Yeah, and I'm like, what happened? He goes, yeah, you're here now. You're the 7. I'm the 7 now? What happened? So the transition, I do the reorg and all that stuff. I wound up doing it myself, moving positions around, doing all that stuff, because there wasn't anybody else. Mm-hmm. So, and then my new boss, Commander Hempel, he made captain. And he would begin the 7 later on, but he was just coming in when we were doing the transition. So I did all the briefings. And all that stuff. So I worked training. We worked the whole thing and trying to get in, fixing the training pipelines for sessions. So I was, because we were doing these weekend training sessions and it wasn't really working out. Kids would come in and then they'd just disappear. And so we were never getting our goal. So we had this whole thing with boot camp to A school to push. And of course, the one says that's never going to happen. So we pushed that direction anyway. So I left there and I went to, I was detailed to Naval Personnel Development Command since I was a 7 there to work the transition and also hopefully get us pushed to boot camp to A school for everybody. And so on that command, there wasn't anybody there. So I had like 8 hats and I worked for kind of Captain Weckerly. And so I wound up pushing the boot camp to A school.
And this was still in New Orleans,
I was up in Norfolk. We moved to Norfolk.
Okay,
and gotcha. So I had his other, my SES was Mr. Terry Halverson. And I briefed him the whole thing, how we do training. And he said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. And my father, he was a colonel in the reserves. And so was Dr. Dahl, who was my deputy director. And they look at each other, he goes, we'll fix that. And sure enough, when I briefed my friend Mark, who was down at Nets, he goes, brief it. Terry thinks it's dumb. He's going to fix it. And that's it. And so it got fixed. In the meantime, they said the Reserve Force freaked out. Then we had to fix the pipelines and everything. Of course, I got everyone upset because money had to change hands and nobody likes money changing. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So you got an inside view of what the Navy training system looked like and had a hand in helping streamline that and make through transitions.
Well, it got reorganized. And so we created the Centers of Excellence. So Center for EOD and Diving was created. The Center for SEAL SWIC, Center for Intel, Center for us. And also they had with the other one for the Crippies, which information dominance, they wound up taking the IPs and everything. So that got merged in because the Center for Information Professional wasn't working. So it was only guy, Captain Dietz, who became NetworkCom, he made 2-star later on. He got taken on all the IPs and stuff. So we reorganized and everything at Center for Engineering and all that stuff. So it was, and all the pipelines got fixed up. And so there was this thing that popped up. This is a good story. The SEALs created this thing. It was done by a guy out of NETSI. He used this thing called DERF money to create a free fall school in Otay of California. So they had 1 year money, and there was nothing in the out year planning. And so I'm sitting there working with the EOD. I said, where's the money? And I said, this was all messed up, just completely crazy. And so then I got caught in the middle.
How much money are we talking about here?
It was a couple million. Okay. It was like 3 or 4 million. That's all it was. But the issue was it was caught between SOCOM, Army Special Operations Command, and Spec Warcom, are arguing whether that met requirement. I go, why am I in the middle of this? Because, you know, I need to find the money for it and then brief the admiral. And he's like, well, where did this come from? I don't know, somebody made it up. And he went ballistic. And so they had to work on the whole requirements. But the one thing I did get with working with the center, got static line for all EOD techs from the initial pipeline. We put that in. Some people, I got cursed out about the free fall, but I got you static line. We'll start with that. You know, that's it.
Oh, so the free fall never came through. That ended up
the free fall didn't come through.
That canceled.
The light of day,
came over that one. And it was.
There was another thing that I found out. Nobody was filling their billets. I had to change the billets at Fort Benning for Airborne. They had an EOD tech, a SEAL, and a parachute rigger billet. And only the parachute rigger was being filled. And I'm like, I got a hold of the PR deal. I had a meeting. Also, the free fall was the same way, dude. Like 3 or 4 instructors, 1 PRC there who was filling the billets for free fall. And then the SEAL and the EOD tech, they weren't filling the billets. So I talked to the guy named Major Buck Dellinger, who was on Discovery Channel for free fall. And I talked to him. He goes, dude, give me PRCs. I goes, all right. So I got a meeting with the PR detailer, him and Benning and Army Command and all that stuff. And I go, okay, I'll convert them all over. So I went through, did all the manpower changes for their N1, and the PR detailer is going to fill them all. So right now, all the free fall and all those billets are the PR detailers that do it. So the parachute riggers do it because they have to go to parachute riggers have to go to jump school before they go to rigger school because they have to jump their own.
Makes sense. Yeah. So, Mike, we are these are all great stories.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you more stories.
We only have about 17 more minutes left in the program here.
Okay, I got that. Yeah, good story.
And I want to get to your transition and
your
advice on education and stuff like that. So before we do that, any other like bullet point highlights through the end? Did you make 06?
No, I'm in 05. Or terminal 05. I was terminal 05, and then when I met it, I was riding that out. But remember the did you go up to the submarine salvage up in what's it called? I did up in Providence.
No, I did not. I think yeah, I. What year was that?
That was like in 2008, 2009. Dan Schultz was the CEO of Mudsu 2, and I got with him on that. I said. And that one was funny because the Assistant Secretary of Defense wanted it to happen. And so I'm working with NAVC, OOC. They didn't want anything to do with it. And I'm like, okay. So I take them on board. I talk to Dan Schultz. He says he can do it. But I need NAVC's assistance and raising a submarine off the bottom. That sunk. That was the Widowmaker. Remember the storm? It hit the pier and it sank.
Yeah. I'd have to check on the timeline, but I believe that the unit, the Cleveland Mudsu unit, had been decommissioned by then. And yeah. I segued off to be the CO of the NEDU reserve unit out of Great Lakes for a few years. I think it was in that time frame. And yeah. I mean, we're doing experimental diving, and yeah. you know, there was only eight of us. So the NADU folks were not necessarily going to send us on a salvage, you know, boondoggle.
Well, I paid for it. Yeah. I didn't pay for it. It was DOD was paying for it. So I had this big pot of money, and this is kind of funny. So Dan got up there, and he was bringing all this stuff from the, what's it called? The SM.
SM.
Yeah, SM yeah. sent all this stuff up there. They got all this stuff in there, and I'm paying for the bill. And I got the Army guys going up there too, which NAVC-0C got upset about, but it has to be joint because the colonel who's in charge goes.
There are Army divers too.
Yes. The Army has divers. They're there. And so I funded them, got the money to Dan. And then I had this big pot of money and I'm executing it. And so they're getting ready to do the whole thing. And then at the last minute, it was like towards the end of the summer, the National Guard and, you know, the Army Reserve, you know, they don't like each other at all, right?
Well, I got that sense through some of the interviews and talking to people. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they don't like it because it could be. So it's always funny when the meetings I said the IRT program, this is how we fund it. Innovative Training and Training. It's usually about a budget, about $24, $25 million. And it has to do with anything domestic that you're going to, military is going to do has to fall under this program. It has to be approved by the military reps I handled, Navy. There was a Marine. And then you had Air National Guard, National Guard, and you had Air Force Reserve and Air Army Reserve. Because notice the National Guard, the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard sat next to each other, meaning on the opposite corner was the Air Reserve and the Army Reserve. And me and the Marines sat next to each other, the whole, you know, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps team.
Department of the Navy, right?
Yeah, it was it. We're Department of the Navy. And so the colonel was in charge, and they dumped, the Army National Guard dumped $2 million at the end of the year. But I'm still doing this op. And the colonel's freaking out because the principal deputy has to brief that to, you know, the House and the Senate. And so they're like, oh, they're all freaking out. I go, Colonel, I can execute those dollars in accordance with the appropriation. He goes, you can do it? And I go, yes, I can do it. Don't know yet, but I'll figure it out on the way up. I'm going to go back to the walk to the annex. So on the way there, I was thinking the SM pool. I was like, dude, don't you have pumps that blew up or something? Don't you have bad pumps? Yeah. We got that stuff. $72 million because I had to execute the dollars in the court, the appropriation. So I said, these things are all running, barely make it. Remember all the yellow gear from World War II?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how that stuff is still running. Because, yeah, they were just trying to hold it together with duct tape.
Bulletproof. Yeah.
Yeah, I said, dude, just survey that old stuff and you could buy new stuff. Well, it's funny, but I tell you, the whole person that made it happen was our old dive school buddy, Admiral Tom Eccles.
Okay, yeah.
Everyone was balking at it, and I talked to my Admiral, my three-star Admiral Cotton. He goes, so what's going on with it? He goes, they're balking at it. He goes, do I need to talk to NAVC, and we can make this happen? Because Vice Admiral Cotton, the Vice Admiral. I said, sir, no, I went to dive school with Admiral Eccles. I'm just going to shoot him an email about the op. Raising a submarine. I set the whole thing in food's aid and everything. And then, boom, he sends a rocket to Soup Salve. And, of course, they changed their tune immediately.
No, that's nice. I mean, Tom's a great guy. And did he retire or is he still?
Yeah, he retired. There? And I got him up there. I told Zane, hey, I'll send him funding. It'd be great to go up there because Congressman will be up there. And it's all about engagement. And it's also about PR. So that op.
Sure. Yeah.
I got so much. Attaboys from the principal deputies and the DASDs were all pat me on the back because it was huge. Because
high profile, yeah.
High profile. There were so many congressmen up there, senators. I had Admiral Eccles up there, you know, talking to everybody, engaging. It was.
Yeah, it worked out, man. Yeah, look at you, master puppet master behind the scenes with all this money changing hands. Yeah,
you gotta figure getting the right resources, everybody. And so.
Only 05. Under the radar, making things happen, right?
Yeah, and it's like you got to make it happen and doing it. And it goes, and people don't realize how big the viz is when you're doing something like that. Coast Guard was happy because it was blocking a channel. It got that up out of the way. And you could see the video when they raise it because they hadn't done it. Admiral Eccles said, we haven't done this since World War II, raise a submarine. So I got rotated engine duty officers in there for training. The Army got to work. So I think it was Dan Schultz said, it's good. So these guys can't bail out of an op when we're doing another recovery mission. You guys can just show up too. That was part of the thing too. Show that they can do it too. Get them out. So it was really good. I mean, everyone got a lot of training out of it, which is the whole point of the IRT program. Rotating engineer duty officers using the POSSE program, and then they're using the submarine.
Mike, you got to write memoirs. You got like so many stories we could go on, and they're all. You have a really sharp memory, and
oh yeah,
all the intricacies of what goes on, and yeah, I got to link you up with Eric Hommel because he wrote a book, and it's in a similar fashion of like all the things that happened, and really it's really a historical document, and
yeah
that would be great. So let's transition from your Navy experience to like, what'd you do when you first got out? I mean, how did you get into education, and what should service members transitioning out of active duty kind of look for if they're interested in training and education? Of course, Mobius does training and education on maintenance and reliability, but like, what tips do you have, or what was that experience like?
Yeah. Well, when I left, I think I married my wife at the time, Maria, and we had Joaquin, my son. So I stayed local and I got a job with Booz Allen Hamilton because my buddy of mine.
Defense consultant contractor.
Yeah, Booz Allen Hamilton, defense consulting. And I was working and I had lunch with his principal, senior associate. So gave me an offer. That was my
interview. So you knew. So it was networking.
Yeah. It's all networking.
Trusted friendships. Yeah.
Get your friends in there. And then I worked there for a year, and then we decided to get out of D.C., so I moved my job down here, and I got a job hooked up with the NASA guys. So I was working Space Missile Center, NASA, and everything. And for a whole time, I had a great gig going. And then somebody released insider information on the network down there. They emailed it out. Some guy came in. Hey, I got all this information, shot it all on the network, and somebody found out, and we got debarred.
Okay, so this was a Booz Allen employee.
Yeah, Booz Allen. That was back in 2012. It's 2012, and this guy got us all debarred. So all of us wound up finished up our contracts and got let go. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm going, now what am I going to do?
Right.
So I looked around, thought about doing it, and I said, maybe I want to start teaching. So I looked up, there's alternative certification programs, alternative certification. It was called ACT San Antonio. Now it's called Teachworthy. So I went to those guys and I brought my transcripts. I applied and they said, well, come on in. And they have a counselors. And the guy was a counselor, was a principal. He had been 20 something years as a principal at one of the highest schools here in San Antonio. So I give him all my stuff and I go, hey, I want to be a history teacher. He goes, okay, let me look at what you got. So he looks at my transcripts, comes back, calls me back. He goes, but on the sheet goes on top of it, math. And I'm like, but math? He goes, you're exceptionally qualified. And I'm like, yeah, I got a lot of math.
So the path was you looked locally for companies that help transitioning service members into teaching, or just anybody who wants to.
There's alternative certifications. There's teacher
alternative cert. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, because a lot of times you go to high school, you go to college, and you get your education degree and you get a certification.
Right.
Sometimes there's alternative certifications that sponsor people to go through, which is perfect for military. You have the degrees. You just need somebody to sponsor. You take your content exam. I'd take my content exam for math, passed it. I'm good. And then you spend a year. They help tutor you. You have a mentor, and they help you with all the pedagogy, which is how you teach. And then pedagogy exam. And then you get your certificate. You get a temporary certificate, then you get a permanent certificate. And I did mine through Troops to Teachers, so I got the extra, $3,333.33 the first year, because it's 10 grand over 3 years.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I went to a Title I school, so they provided that. I'm not sure if they're still doing it anymore, but they were doing it then. So you get a little bonus check from NETC. They would send that to you. Actually, was that
Were you getting retirement pay at the
same time? Yeah, I got my retirement pay too.
Okay, so like some of our other guests, leveraging the fact that you had retirement pay as your base sustainability,
Put
food on the table, paying the mortgage and all that type of stuff, you were able to like choose what you wanted to do. And so this is important because many people might be under the mistaken impression that they need to go back to college, get a teaching degree, be certified and stuff like that. So what you're saying is there are alternate methods and it's a big need out there too, right?
Yeah, especially with what military provides, especially with the math and sciences, they don't have enough. You got a lot of people teaching history or whatever, but like if you can teach math, you're good. So you can get in those ways for the alternative certifications. So that's what I did. I taught 2 years in high school down to a Title I school. And then I was like, I need to get out of this. So I didn't, I stopped doing it because my ex had already started a coffee business and I got kind of into roasting.
Okay.
And that was my old thing. I bought a big roaster and I was doing all that stuff for a couple of years. And I did that.
Renaissance man, coffee roaster.
I was coffee roasting. I had a good time. I learned how to do it on YouTube and all that stuff.
Smells good. Yeah.
So I did that for a few years. And then I got back into, at the community college, tutoring math, because I already done that. Just as a little side hustle, because I wasn't working every day. So I squeezed in that. And then I became friends with the adjunct coordinator. He goes, give me your transcript. So he looked at me and goes, dude, you only need one class. But you have 16 credits. You only need 18. And you can teach college level. And I went, really? So I signed up for a class at University of Incarnate Word here and for research statistics, took the class, got an A, got 3 more credit hours, and they brought me on as an adjunct faculty. And I've been doing that ever since.
Nice. So really it's a matter of getting in and getting some help from people who understand the system because there's a big need there, there in math and science is what I'm hearing. And, and certainly, you know, it depends on your demeanor and your patience, so whether you want to deal with high school students or work with potentially more mature semi-adults in the college ranks. Right. So, cool. And that brings us to where you are today, right?
Yeah. Community college. Cause if you again, like, because during that time period, I got bad news. And so, cause the VA screwed me over. Cause I got, when I left the military, I had stenosis in my C5, C6 with spinal cord lesion. And as I talked to my neurologist, he looked at it, he goes, how'd they give you zero? They should have gone high order. You have a spinal cord lesion. And so
from your time in the military, exposure to asbestos.
I started getting buzzing in my fingers. So if you get buzzing in your fingers or something like that, you need to get an MRI. So they gave me an MRI before I left. So it was in my record. And when looking through, because my thyroid had died in 2019, my TSH level was like 65. So they're on the end and this nurse, she was an army nurse, a nurse doctor. And she was going through and looking at my record. She goes, I see this. And look at it, and she like flips out. She sees my record, and she goes, oh, my God. And she's freaking out. I'm like going, what's going on? I'm fine. She goes, no, you're not. No, you're not. And she's like, oh, you need an MRI. You need this. And she's like totally wigging out. And I'm like, what's going on? You need to get MRIs. And so I go in there, and she's scheduling me. And I went back to my next appointment. Goes, hey, my face feels kind of funny. Like it's going kind of numb. And then she freaks out again, and they got me in. Because I had another attack. So I had multiple sclerosis. Didn't know it at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so I finally get to a neurosurgeon after doing MRIs. He goes, son, you don't need a neurosurgeon. Stenosis is okay, but you need a neurologist. And I go, I'm like, you know what MS is? And I'm like, yeah, I lied. What you're talking about.
About to find out, right?
Yeah, I probably got a neurologist. And my VA neurologist is pretty funny. I have an appointment with him today at 3, the virtual. But he looks and goes, they told me I pinched a nerve. He goes, no, it's right here. So I have a lesion. I have a spinal cord. I have a lesion in my brain and my pons medullary and basement brain. And I got one in my C2 to C3 was my first one. That was in 2010 when I had it. Actually, I first got it in 2007. And then I have a C3, C4 that I don't know when that happened. And then, so I have 3 of them. So they got me on, I'm on MS medication. Shoot up, because I'm lucky it happened on active duty because the VA covers it and it's expensive.
Yeah, well, sorry to hear that. And, and this sort of dovetails into the PAC Act, right? Yeah. And that's because do you remember just being on the ships with the asbestos or a particular event that caused you?
It's overall exposure.
Long-term exposure, yeah.
Exposure. Yeah. He tells me about that because it's environmental time with some genealogy or something like that, because a lot of times it's driven by exposure, why military have a higher rate of MS and lupus and all that stuff than people don't have service. So it's just one of the things too. And they have two centers of excellence. I talk about it. The VA, they have one on the West Coast and East Coast. The VA.
Okay.
And so they really cater to us because we have a higher number of people with MS. And they've also traced back from the military records that MS is tied to Epstein-Barr virus, because they looked at the records of people from TRICARE and the people who have MS that they're all positive for Epstein-Barr.
Interesting. Epstein-Barr is a genetic.
It's a virus.
Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Epstein-Barr virus. Mm-hmm. So it could be caught while you're on active duty or whatever. Who knows? And also environmental. And so they don't really know exactly. And that was part of that Project 2025. They want to cut benefits for people who have lupus or MS. And I'm like, guys, it's caused by environmental. A lot of it comes from that.
Interesting.
We had PCBs, but PBOT was a toxic dump.
Well, yeah, especially in the main spaces. I mean, and Minesweeper too, from my perspective. I mean, you have an oil soaked hull.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're going around Cape Hatteras in the wintertime and you're getting the crap beat out of you, all the salt water is leaching through the deck into your stateroom and sloshing around on the floor. So, yeah. So I am fortunate, I suppose, to have only been, you know, doing that for the amount of time that I was. You did it for a lot longer and, you know, unfortunate. And so sorry to hear that. Glad to have you with us and, you know, immortalizing this in digital as well. So I think the advice is for anybody on active duty that's not feeling probably quite right, you know, do some research, do double, triple checks, get a second opinion and make sure you understand your rights via the PACT Act, which I think was just signed into legislation couple of years ago, perhaps.
I had on active duty, so the PACT Act wasn't really needed, because I had checked with the Center of Excellence. Goes, if you had a spinal cord lesion on active duty, you're fine. You're going to get rated. Don't worry about it. Because that's
it's important, right? I mean,
yeah, and you got to follow
quality of life. Yeah, yep.
You got to watch all that stuff too. But the thing is, I'm going back into is, as we talked about before, teaching is looking at more of an option. Or selling insurance or financial planning. That's what most people do when they come out of active duty now. Because the defense market is shutting down right now. The GS positions aren't going to be there for you to retire and go into. And the contracting jobs are going to get circuit and slashed. So you're looking at it right now, the environment. What are you going to do coming out of active duty? You can teach personal financial planning, selling insurance, maybe try to
training. Training is a part of every branch of the military, right? Yeah. So, and Mobius as a training hub is supporting and enhancing what's going on there. But every corporation that I've ever been involved in has trainers, and not only for the internal people, but also for if you're selling something, like I was in the lubricant business for a while. Yeah. There's no college courses on lubricants. I was a mechanical engineering graduate, and I had one class not the entire course, but one class within one course in the entire curriculum that even talked about. You probably learn more about lubricants in the military.
Yes.
Especially on ships that have drivetrains and everything like that, or be it motor pools in the Army or the Marines or aviation or whatever, right? Then you learn outside. But training doesn't necessarily require a certificate. Now, financial planning and all that can be bigger money, but it does require some certification as well as teaching at the level where you're at too. So that's all good, man. Yeah. Yeah, so you've got a lot of information. Before we sort of wrap up here, I wanted to highlight your dad's experience in maintenance and reliability, because he did this for many years, right, and was giving you advice along the way and all that. And you mentioned before we got on the call, was it ITRI? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, Illinois Institute of Technology Research Institute. It's kind of weird how we went up that because my dad worked for Lucan Steel, which now makes all the plate steel for all the warships. That's all they do. They make that there. He was a deputy plant manager there. And he worked at Corning one time when he was at U.S. Steel. And then he wound up after he got his master's at Penn State, your alma mater. He got his He was industrial engineer at Dayton. He got his master's in dental engineering science. And then he passed his PE exam because he wanted to get it. And he wound up going to Carrier. So he made air conditioners for like 25, 26 years. And then he had the same experience you had when he got to 57. They let him go.
It happens.
You got to find another job. And so Itri picked him up because they were looking for somebody with manufacturing experience. So he's telling me all this stuff. So he wound up, he did some industry stuff and then they slid him over to DOD. And so he was working the AAAV project and they were trying to build the AAAV in Lima.
My dad
was a sub to a sub to a sub to a sub because they found him. And he.
They had a lot of analysis.
Yeah.
With that particular high tech in the AAV. All right. So why don't you explain what it is?
Well, they were building it in Lima and my dad was like, they're just ripping them off because I could build this thing for a tenth of the cost. I don't know what the hell.
Okay. Well, describe what the acronym means.
Well, the AAAV is the Advanced Amphibious Assault Vehicles.
And that's what I thought. Yeah.
And so he was helping the colonel. He goes, what's going on? So he says, I'll tell you why they're ripping you off. And I'll write it all down. I can brief you next week. So he got the whole thing in. He wrote it down. And the colonel's like, what? Because I did manufacturing for 30 years. I can build that a lot cheaper. So
yeah, so really, really great combination of experience manufacturing and reliability. And then moving towards spec analysis for DOD contractors, right? Which which may not be like obvious for folks coming out of the military, but if they can get into manufacturing, maintenance and reliability, that augments. Well, first off, they have a baseline from the military, and it just augments their resume and their experience level. So then you can come back and weave your way in. But
And my dad worked at note that Itri Rand, now Alliance Science Technology, runs the Reliability Analysis Center for DOD, and that's where he worked. So he was going reliability analysis with the torpedo programs in Mark 48s. They couldn't figure out reliability on it. So my dad wrote a paper on single-shot devices. And if you can find that in the rack, you can download it. It's from Edward R. Sherwin. And you can download it. You can Google it. It's on DTIC. And you can download it. And it made it really simple. So he changed the entire torpedo program. They used to overhaul the torpedoes over so many years. And then you did all the analysis on it. Just stop messing with them. Leave them alone. They're hermetically sealed. Only overhaul one that's in the torpedo tube and leave the rest of them alone. And he changed the whole torpedo maintenance and reliability analysis for the torpedoes. So he'd work whenever they lost a torpedo or a torpedo didn't work, they would send it to him. And one time it was funny when I was at NPDC, my dad was visiting me because he goes, hey man, what's your fax number? I go, dad, it's this one. He goes, I got something coming over. And it was a Mark 56 torpedo. They were doing vibration tests on it. My dad told him, don't do it. You're at 800% tolerance. And so it came with the facts. And my friend Monty and a couple of guys for aviation maintenance guys, we were looking at this thing, come to all the pictures. I'm like going, the hell was this? I think it was a torpedo. It's all twisted and it's destroyed. So I brought it home to my dad and he's like, yelled at him, you idiots. I told you not to do this. You own Raytheon $1.5 million for a torpedo.
Yikes. Well, interesting stories and great stuff. So, Mike, if people want to reach out to you and dig into some of this stuff or get some advice, what's the best way for them to contact you? Are you on LinkedIn or anything on like LinkedIn, that? Or you have an email address?
My email address is just M.M. Sherwin with the number 1@gmail. It's the easiest way. I don't check. I get a lot of spam on LinkedIn. Oh my gosh, it's crazy. LinkedIn's like,
yeah, I do too. I mean,
it's like, how many do I get? I mean, it shows
there's all sorts of social media bots, you know, posing as, oh, hey, I like your experience.
Oh yeah.
Sometime. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Somebody starting to sell you something or all that stuff. You get a LinkedIn opportunity. Who's who?
Yeah, you can waste a lot of time posing as something as they're not. So be careful. So, okay. So the Gmail is probably the best way. And
then
through Mobius or whatever. But so we're out of time, my friend. I really, we might have to do a round two. We'll see if we got more. So sleep on this, listen to this when it comes out. And if we got more, we can absolutely do a Mike Sherwin round two. We've done that with other folks, but we want to keep it within the confines of nice little packet to deliver to the podcast people. Yeah.
Look at it right now is that one of my advice I was telling, it's like Taco Bell, think outside the bun when you're leaving. outside the bun, because we traditionally go to these contractor jobs and everything, and if all that stuff's going away because of the cuts and all that stuff, you got to think outside the bun and think about other opportunities and really do some research what you're really interested in, because you can do lots of things. But remember, you're also going to start at the bottom. Like teaching, I was a new teacher, so it doesn't matter if I was a commander in the Navy, I'm a new teacher. You're starting at something completely new to yourself. So
be humble. Right?
Yeah, be humble. Yeah. Well, don't say that. Oh, I always experience it. It doesn't really apply necessarily in the civilian world, as you know, because you're a corporate guy. So the military experience does, and sometimes it doesn't, because it's different. They're different, especially teaching.
Well, it's something to be proud of, right? But, this goes back to, some of the challenges the veterans have as they transition out of the service. It's their identity is in the uniform, and the credentials are on, your ribbons and your medals. Yeah. Whereas, when you're changing, it's part of who you are for sure, but not the only part of who you are. Yeah. You're a dad, you're a husband, you're a brother, a son, a friend, and all these things. And it's living your best life. Yeah. So that's great experience, great advice, great wisdom, really, from somebody who's been there and done that. And you've given me a ton of great advice on trying to get into a potential adjunct professorship, which interests me as well. Yeah. Maybe not today, but we'll keep in contact, and perhaps that becomes something in the future. Because really, there's a designing your life book. There's all sorts of good books out there. Actually, I'll bring one up. I can't remember the exact name of it that I'm reading right now. That's really, really, really sharp, that I like a lot. I'll post on LinkedIn and also post here. But and the people you hear on these podcasts are all willing to help. Yeah, go ahead.
Remember, on the civilian side too, they love titles. Everyone loves titles. I love to be something. So civilian side, that's why a lot of times is lost Ron to say, you don't see any haze gray paint under my fingernails. I'm not hanging on to it, because people do. And that's why a lot of people never go into retirement. Like, I retired early. Good thing, because you have a retirement check, you can do the FIRE concept, financial independence, retire early, because you have that disability retirement. So you can slide into something else or do barista FIRE, like I'm working part-time. They call that barista FIRE. So FIRE concept is a really good one to think about too, when you want to tail off working. Because the earlier you retire, the more healthier, the better off you are in the longer term. So,
sure, lower stress, more choices.
Lower stress.
It doesn't mean you have to stop doing everything, right? Yeah. It just means you have the freedom to do what you want and try out different things.
Yes.
And really trying out different things and seeing if it's what you thought it was, or you really like it. Is it a true passion, or is it a hobby? That type of thing. I mean, it's very, very valid. And with the safety net of the retirement that the service provides, or, I guess in the future it'll be 401k, more of 401k than a pension. But in any case, that's great advice. So.
Yeah, good. That's what I think about. Think about your health first. So I have health issues. So it's all that stuff you can think about too. And changing up, like my ex, she's a yoga and a fitness instructor, because she's got her retirement and disability. And so she's teaching yoga because that's what she wants to do. And so
she's getting fit every day. And
she's working out, getting paid to work out.
Give it back.
Free gym membership, working out. So you think outside the bun. And also thinking about also what's enough. My dad used to say to me all the time, figure out how much is enough. And once you have enough, do what you want to do.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt, because if you've saved enough, then the interest, theoretically, the interest on your savings, it may even pay you, if you got enough, may even pay you more than what you can make in a regular job. So if you're making enough, right, and then you can do what you want, oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the the brass ring, right?
Yeah. And your stress goes away completely. You're not worried about, oh, I got to get to work, but whatever. Doesn't matter. I do what I want to do, and I'm good, because all that stress just goes away because it's not healthy. Because stress is bad. It helps. It incurs relapses. So I always had to remove stress. So it's all good.
Well, talking to you today has relieved some of my stress. Hopefully it has for you too, because now we're in the total give back part of our program, our career, our lives, our living our best lives. So thanks, Mike. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and talk to us on this mission. And so people can get a hold of you. What, once more, what's your Gmail address?
It's just MMSherwin, SHERWIN, with a number 1 at the end, just the 1, @gmail.com.
Right on, right on. Okay, so before we close out, I'd like to give a couple short notes to our listeners. First, I want to personally invite you to join us in Milwaukee in September 2025, the 8th and the 9th, for Mobius Connect Live. It's one-of-a-kind event packed with real-world applications and valuable connections with fellow CBM practitioners and reliability professionals. I'll be hosting a special live episode of Veterans Connected at this event. It's a unique opportunity for us to come together, share stories, learn from each other, and dig into what it means to be a veteran in today's industry. So mark your calendars and register now. Can't wait to see you in Milwaukee. Second, to round out our show, we're seeking more female veterans as well as recently transitioned vets. If you know any former service members that would be interested in telling their stories, send them our way. That means you too, Mike. If you got any buddies, you rattle off a lot of names during this interview. So if you think any of those folks would be interested in being on, please send them our way. So thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mobius, as well, for providing this platform and helping transitioning vets as well as those looking to hire them. So this is it. It's a wrap. Thank you so much, Mike. It's been a great pleasure to see you and talk to you again. And let's keep in touch.
All right. Take care, man.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Veterans Connected. We'll see you back for another episode very soon. In the meantime, we hope to see you in the Veterans Connected community group, where you can meet Eric and fellow podcast guests and share with other industry veterans at MobiusConnect.com. We hope to see you there.